recording now.
We are?
Okay. Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. You didn't get what he just said about how everything's going to change. I'm kidding.
Everything's
fine. So we're here again. We have Richard B. Ward, who's a core architect on Windows. He was in our Rob Short interview we did over Christmas.
Yep.
And we wanted to sit down and talk to him a little bit today, more about state management and security in Vista and the work that he's done. So welcome again,
okay. Richard. Thanks.
Cool.
Try and speak up to
yep.
keep the Slashdot crowd happy.
Or we could get closer.
Are we really close? Okay, that feels great.
Speak up, damn it. So let's talk about what are some of the core changes that have been made at the OS level for security? Like what's going on? How is Vista more secure? It's a broad question. At the core level.
At the core level? I guess you have to divide the question in two areas. There are security features that have been added, and there's been security practices that are adopted and promulgated through the system. So what would you like to focus on first?
Let's start with the latter.
The security practices?
Yes.
Okay. So definitely a hot topic. Mm-hmm. We have done a lot of work throughout the system. In fact, you can see this now in the SDK that has gone out, actually that went out with the PDC, in terms of annotating the system interfaces and functions. So it's not really rocket science, but it's okay. A very basic engineering principle that more than just defining what parameters go in and out of a function, we're actually defining some semantics around the parameters themselves. So simple annotations are what goes in, what goes out. Mm-hmm. More complicated ones cover, for example, what's the length of the argument that's going in, how to interpret other arguments, or what comes out, how long something should be expected. This gives our static analysis tools a lot more information to use when evaluating code paths for correctness. So I don't have any numbers, for example, what problems have been caught, but mm-hmm. Classes of problems involve things where components had faulty assumptions. And so the owner of an API or a function can say, okay, here's what the rules are, because I'm defining them. And mm-hmm. then the static analysis tools run, and they examine all the code paths. They do their localized analysis. They do their full system scope analysis. Mm-hmm. And they say, oh, hey, this other guy you've never heard of is calling your API, and they're calling it incorrectly. Lag it, bug it, fix it. So that level of work is huge.
Okay. And
it sounds simple. It scales enormously well, because having one person go through and annotate all these functions would be painful and tedious. But in fact, we started the annotation for Windows Server 2003 SP1, to keep the branding police off my back.
Yeah.
But, we did the first round of annotations there. We annotated all the kernel functionality inside of 2 weeks. It took 8 people, starting with Dave Cutler. I helped out with a chunk. All the other base developers pitched in. And we found numbers of actual bugs that were fixed based on tracking this kind of faulty assumption down. So based on that, it was very easy to fan that out and apply it broadly across Vista.
Outstanding.
So. And that's one example of the practices. And there are things that aren't as easily managed or not as easily measured, such as, okay, every component's doing a threat model. And we started doing threat models in Server 03, Server 03 SP1. Mm-hmm. As the process is getting more and more refined, there are more tools to help people walk through mm-hmm. their how to piece together a threat model, how to file that in the system, team of experts from the Secure Windows Initiative are going through it to evaluate things, make sure that test plans correspond to threat models.
And, sure.
The auditing aspect of it is helpful, but the better part of it is getting the teams to think about what they're trying to solve up front.
Mm-hmm.
Thinking back, I was the overall architect for XPSV2, and had a lot of people who were like, oh, security, all right, we have to be, we're going to defend against this, great. We're going to defend against the admin doing this. No, that's not a security. That's, you can argue that we want to make the system more reliable and correct, but it's not a security thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so formalizing the threat model made people think about what was really a management or reliability thing that should be fixed for whatever reason to make it a better system, and a security threat which needs to be addressed or mitigated on an a different axis.
Fantastic.
You know, there's a lot of work going against what we call fuzzing, analyzing all the file formats that we're using, trying to make sure that we can fuzz against bad input coming in.
Okay. And
doing that in an automated fashion as much as possible balances the annotation. So we have the static analysis, which tries to prevent problems. We have penetration and fuzz testing, which are active test things.
So it's runtime testing.
Runtime, yeah.
Fantastic.
So there's a lot of little work going on like that. Mm-hmm. I say little in the sense of the not in the overall effect, but the actual burden on any given team or any given developer is fairly light, but the net effect is actually pretty significant.
Fantastic. And so now, what about features in Vista that you consider exemplary security features?
The big security feature is the user account control. This is the brand name now. This is the feature where even when someone's an admin, we're going to reduce the privilege that they're actually running most of their applications at to ordinary user. And it's a difficult one to fully kind of grok, because it's a security feature in the sense that we're actually making it more compelling and more useful for all the ISVs in the world to write their applications to not require being admin anymore. There's a tool that is, I think it went out with the SDK, we were handing it out at the PDC, called the Lua Predictor, where people can run against their applications, figure out if they're going to have problems running as ordinary user. It looks for a bunch of common mistakes, like opening registry keys for all access as opposed to read, and things like that. Okay. Opening files that they shouldn't be opening files. Writing to places other than in the user's profile, simple tests like that. And the vast majority of failures to run as ordinary users revolve around these kind of assumptions that carried forward with the Windows 95 style code base, where it was more of a free-for-all,
sure,
to put it politely. So the UAC, I view it as it's a huge tool, but it's a tool to change the industry more than it is something that gives you individual protection. Because fundamentally, you're still an admin, and you can make it the wrong decision. Now, there's a complementary effort to make sure the user is more informed, that the user understands when they're actually doing something that's admin-sensitive, when they're changing the configuration of the system as opposed to something on the actual, just something local to the user.
Sure.
We don't care if you change your background color. We don't care.
Can you change the system clock now?
The system clock has finer granularity. System clock is a great thing. Everyone loves to point out, guys are idiots. But the point is, if you tamper the system clock, then you blow the audit trail. It's hard to prove what's going on. For NT4, I had to add an unlock audit for a specific customer because they lost the prosecution. They couldn't prove that someone came back and locked their workstation because there was no entry in the audit log describing exactly what happened. Mm. And they lost it. They lost a criminal case. So,
the clock is
an important thing. Now, you balance that against, it sounds simple, mm-hmm. but, it took a couple rounds, but there's a separate privilege now for changing the time zone as opposed to the
now,
clock
I would,
itself.
I would like to interject, though, that the complaints that I had made in the past were not the fact that, someone running in user context could change the system time, but rather they could actually launch it and look at the calendar.
Yeah.
That was mainly what I was... But I can understand, when you lock it down, you lock it down. Because then you'd have to do finer, but now you say there's finer granularity.
It's finer granularity. So, right, the simple things like, maybe we shouldn't have when you wave the mouse over the clock in the corner that it dies. As if you're not it just dies. It doesn't let you bring up the calendar.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we fixed that. And actually, Raymond Chen had a great blog entry about how the clock tool was written in Win9X days where it actually changed the time live, right? So if you're paging through the calendar, it was changing the date under the covers, and that's that particular code carried forward, which and which was not the right design, let's say. So now they correctly decide, you know, if you want to skip ahead in the calendar, they show you what's going on. Mm-hmm. They don't try and change the time. We also listen to corporate customers who say, hey, we got a road warrior with a laptop. He's traveling all over the country. He's got to change his local time zone. Mm-hmm. But we don't want him to be an admin. We're, you know, we're trying to manage these laptops. Okay, so now there is a separate privilege for changing time zone. And now you can change the time zone trivially.
Okay.
And so that's just making the system a little more manageable in my mind by changing the security granularity from something that was 15 years old to something that's more current.
Fantastic. Now, you mentioned creating, so in this new security context where I'm signed in as an admin, running as an admin, but my applications may be running as non-admin, like let's say my internet browser. Good not to be running as an admin. You should never have to run as an admin and surf the net. However, what about backward compatibility? So I have applications that I have on there that have to run as admin. What happens there?
Well,
why did you laugh?
Backwards compatibility is our greatest strength and our worst scourge, right? There's a fair amount of work that went into the feature called UAC that is about maintaining backwards compatibility. It's, for example, you know, there's file system virtualization so that applications that are writing to things in the file system they shouldn't be, we can catch that, redirect that to a place in the user's profile where it doesn't cause any harm. Games are
interesting.
Games are notorious for this. They, you know, they have any file or something like that where they maintain high scores. It's in the programs. Silly stuff like that. We can catch that with a file system redirection. There's redirection and virtualization in the registry as well to handle that kind of case. IE brings a whole another set of issues to the table. So before diving too deep into that, we added a notion of integrity control to Windows Vista this release. And classic integrity control is 30 years old. All the Padula model kind of stuff. Actually, this is the Beba model of integrity. The problem with the classic integrity model is very, very hard to manage. We're trying to find a better middle ground where you get the benefits of saying, of expressing the integrity of data and code as well. I trust this completely. It's like my operating system. I trust this code or this data more because I wrote it, and I trust the stuff that I downloaded off the web the least because I don't know where it came from, it just came from some website. We had a precursor to this in XBSP2 when we started tagging the I can't remember some horrible abbreviation, but it was the part of downloads. We tagged files that were downloaded from the net with the zone and the site that they came from. Mm-hmm. Is an alternate data stream, so that when you click on it in the shell says, oh, this came from the net, did you really want to do that? Mm-hmm. That was not a security feature per se, right? Because if I go to a command shell and I type the process, you know, foo.exe, it's going to launch, there's going to be no warning that it came from the net. Mm-hmm. This is trying to take that to the next step, which is, you know, now that we had some little practical experience in XBSV2, people started seeing this, this came from the net, we're very sure you know what you're doing, let's take that a little farther, and now IE, for example, run in what we call the lowest integrity. Mm-hmm. So stuff that you download from the internet zone gets tagged as being low integrity stuff at the lowest level of the file system, and it's done by the operating system, not by a cooperative download effort through the shell. So now, hey, this file is tagged as low integrity. You can't necessarily run it automatically. You know, it has to be upgraded before it can be run. Same with files, and also this instance of low integrity IE, if it gets taken over by some malicious site, its avenues of escape are severely constrained. It can't write anywhere in the operating system anymore. It can read anywhere, so you still have an information disclosure problem, but it can't necessarily tamper everything they have running locally. Okay. So by trying these new partitioning techniques, we're trying to separate out things that you have high trust, moderate trust, and are scared of. When taken as a whole, it's actually kind of a compelling story.
Absolutely.
So,
And so the user can't, in this case, won't be able to say, okay, run it, I trust it. At runtime, at like when it prompts it.
Therein lies the application compatibility story, right?
Okay.
So clearly if they're downloading Flash or Adobe and they can't run what they just downloaded, it would be terrible, right?
Absolutely.
So you know, the application compatibility story here is, okay, hey, you know, it's a signed download. Okay, therefore it's got, you know, we trust it more, i.e. it's actually split itself into kind of a multitude of pieces. The lowest privilege IE can send it over to the higher privilege one, the higher privilege one, or the higher trust one, and say, hey, you know, we just downloaded it, has a signature, things look good, do you want me to run it or not? And so the user's still involved, the user still has to make a decision, mm-hmm. but hopefully it's not going to be any worse than it is. Won't be any worse user experience wise than it is currently,
okay.
in the sense that the user is involved, he has to make a decision, there's always the risk of the user getting numb to these kind of questions being pelted constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the balance is, okay, the lower integrity instances of the thing can't affect the rest of the system easily.
Mm-hmm.
Is it bulletproof? I hope so.
Yeah.
We're going to get, we'll see how close it is. You know, experience says nothing's ever perfect. We're going through this fairly rigorously, trying to find all the avenues of communication and escape, and trying to make sure that this lower integrity version of instance of IE can't affect anything else, can't drive any other applications, can't lay any mines. Right? We went through a whole round of problems with IE where someone could guess where a temporary file was stored and then invoke it through something else. It would bypass the zone detection. Well, once again, if the thing is tagged by the file system as being low integrity and not to be trusted by higher integrity stuff, you've got a stronger wall there.
Absolutely. Sounds good.
Sounds good.
It's a hard problem. I mean, we were just talking to the InfoCard team today.
Yeah.
So one of the nice things would be able to know that the application that I'm downloading is coming from a place that I trust implicitly. So maybe there'll be some use of InfoCard with, you know, running in a high context IE,
because it's, I trust it.
InfoCard, I think, is a huge step forward. In a certain sense, if you look way back, some of the things that we talked about for what was coded Hailstorm a long time ago had the underpinnings of this, which was, hey, do we have some identity cards that we can have site-specific identity? The saddest thing about InfoCard is that they had to run down level, so they can't take advantage of some of the new features in Vista yet. So hopefully they'll be able to turn around and rev themselves pretty quickly and start using some of the Vista separation. Tied in other ways.
Cool. So when you talk about separation, are you talking about virtualization? So are you talking about, I mean, is there virtualization? So you mentioned earlier the compatibility of an older application that has to run as admin, and you mentioned virtualization. So as far as the app's concerned, it's seeing the file system, right? It thinks that it's really operating against the constructs it's expecting to, and you're doing that through virtualization.
Yeah. So virtualization is there for app compatibility and lets things run when they would have failed otherwise. Separation in this sense is we have, you know, like the integrity levels separate applications in the system.
Okay.
I don't know how much you got into InfoCard when you were talking to whoever it was just prior to this.
Arun and company.
Okay. They switch desktops. They have this prompting methodology where the user is involved and knows that he's talking to InfoCard, and InfoCard bundles up all the information, sends it back to the application in a way that can't be tampered. And, you know, a lot of good thought has gone into that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when they're able to use Vista specific features in the future, then there's going to be additional things like, okay, they can tie in with the rest of the secure prompting that's going on in Vista. To dive down deeply for a second, Vista, when you run something that has to run in an admin context, you want to make sure that the user makes the decision that this thing is going to run as an admin, not the code. Right? So the code says, I run best when I'm an admin, for example.
Mm-hmm.
If you run the CTP or whatever has come out lately, when people actually see this video, we'll see that. I don't know. Yeah,
By the time this is released,
there'll be a new CTP out. I don't, you know, the people signed up for it or downloaded it on MSDN, blah, 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 pitch.
Yeah.
when you do that, you'll see and say, oh, okay, I'm going to run MMC to manage my computer. And it's going to, there'll be a little prompt that bubbles up and says, hey, do you want, you know, this thing needs to run as an admin, click allow or cancel. We want to make sure that no other application can tamper with that. We don't want anyone sending it. So it's insulated from getting keystrokes or input from other applications. There's a, the integrity levels that, that I was talking about earlier pervade the Windows system for a change. So everything, even though they're on the same desktop, there's separation in terms of what messages can be passed across applications running at different integrity levels.
Okay.
So for example, back to the lower right side, or the lower integrity IE,
mm-hmm.
Assuming the worst happened, it's running some control that get overrun, and it decides that it's going to send out messages, they're going to get blocked. It can tell other applications on the desktop to minimize, to get out of the way, but it can't tell them, here's the input I want you to use, or here's what your control thinks that it returned, and stuff like that.
Sure.
So on the same front, InfoCard wants to make sure that no one else is talking to the user, and the user knows that it's talking, that the user is talking to InfoCard. They want to make sure that trusted path is established. They're doing the user to InfoCard by that choice of glyph that the user sees and other visual characteristics that are hopefully not visible to any other application. And conversely, want to make sure that no one else can drive them. And so on XP, they're doing it through a desktop switch. They've got a number of insulating characteristics there.
Mm-hmm.
On Vista, they can go beyond that by having maintain better context by not switching out desktops, but taking advantage of the same secure prompting infrastructure that we have inside of the UAC broker.
Now, what about actual running code? So,
we don't do that anymore.
So let's, one of the basic security exploits are buffer overrun vulnerabilities. So if a buffer overrun vulnerability happens in an application that's running in low writes, I'm not saying IE, I'm saying any application that's running in low writes, that application, even though I, as a hacker, get in and take control and start trying to run some code to exploit that, will only affect, that is enclosed and cannot spread out to the system.
That's the goal.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I just wanted to reiterate that.
Okay. So, yeah. Like I said, I alluded to earlier, we have a lot of static analysis tools that are going through, and they check for correctness of code, they check for boundary conditions. There's a lot of interesting work that's done there. There's a lot of research papers that we published, and there's a group that came over from MSR that joined the Windows team during the core reorg a year and a half ago. And they've done a lot of great work in terms of simulating data paths and code paths and finding out when, where can this buffer calculation be done incorrectly and leading to an overrun. And so everyone likes to point to the stupid stuff, like, the guy takes a long string and just does stir copy and game over. Well, okay, those are easy to track down and find.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of more subtle ones where they're, there's an integer overflow case because the guy added these five things. He read one off off the wire, and everything went to hell.
Mm-hmm.
Hope we can say that on the
totally table. Say anything
okay.
You want.
well, we're not going to challenge that.
If my son's watching Don and Drew, that's okay.
I'll
say Don and Drew.
So, we believe that we've made great strides on buffer overflow prevention. Up front by examining all of our code and doing the static analysis.
Sure.
Is it perfect? No. Right? Mm-hmm. We don't know how perfect it can be. Is it substantially better than it was? Yeah, it's substantially better than it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our first order of defense. Second order of defense is creating a boundary like these integrity levels. Third line of defense is saying, okay, hey, you're not running. There's low integrity and then there's medium integrity. The medium integrity is not running as admin. So
okay.
There's yet another shell, and then when you're finally running as admin, how insulated are you from
sure.
The bad stuff? We're trying to increase that insulation. We're trying to, we can't have a perfect air gap here, but we're going to try and get as close as we can.
Fantastic.
Is it ever going to be possible to say Windows security is perfect?
I don't think you can say that about any software, Windows or otherwise. In isolation, we can take a specific part of a code and analyze it until the end of time, and we say, okay, this bit of code is fine. But by its very nature, we've got a very open, versatile system that has a myriad of configuration points, and there have been decisions that get made that we can't necessarily second guess all the time, right? So we can make a particular component bulletproof against overflow attacks, for example. I'm sure someone's going to correct me online for that. But you know, we can take some component and make it virtually perfect. You know, cost of doing that increases exponentially the more things that you go. So there's that aspect. Then there's also we were just debating in a meeting earlier today. Okay, if we allow iSCSI, do we always require IPsec? Because iSCSI, you know, it's basically SCSI commands over IP on your favorite Ethernet connection. Makes sense for scaling out storage, but has a certain risk, right? Because now, if the data is not preserved between the disk and the machine that's reading it, then there's all sorts of problems there. Okay, so IPsec, well, that would cover it. That's good, but adds overhead. And part of the reason people are doing iSCSI and things like that is because, you know, the data path inside of the bus or the disk to bus isn't increasing as fast as the network speeds are increasing. So it's somewhat more economical to go put disks on the network. So, but they don't want the overhead of having IPsec, integrity checking everything or encrypting everything. But these are industrial, or not industrial, these are enterprise class customers who are deploying this, and they've got actually air gap networks, right? They've got a storage network behind their massive servers, and it's okay not to have. They've compensated the wire security by having physical security. They've protected things. So we have to allow the knob to turn this off, because you know, the overall configuration of the system may be done correctly, but as soon as you have that knob, someone could say, "Oh, I need faster iSCSI access in my house." Or something like that. Not, I doubt many people have iSCSI in their house today. I have no idea what, you know, who's going to win the NAS SAN iSCSI war 5 years from now. And, you know, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So with all these knobs, there's always the chance for misconfiguring your system.
Exactly. I mean, it's a general. It's a great point that you made. Windows is a general purpose operating system. I mean, you don't basically. You have no way of predicting, I would argue, knowing exactly how anybody that uses a particular instance of Windows is going to use it. You have no idea what they're going to install on it. You have, I mean, you can't predict it.
It is a constant surprise as customer feedback comes in. How's that? You're doing what? Yeah. Wow, I didn't know they could do that. Yeah.
And why are you surfing porn sites again?
there are a lot of stories around that.
There probably are some security related.
Oh, yeah.
But, I mean, in terms of configuration management and state and stuff like that, it must be just immensely complex. Yeah. So I think at where it is today, it's amazing. I think SP2 was an incredible evolution in security at the OS level. I've had little problems.
Great.
So I want to ask one quick thing,
okay,
since we're on security. With the recent rootkit experience that customers had from a certain somebody.
not a Microsoft somebody.
absolutely not a Microsoft somebody. Perhaps they were doing it being naive and just taking advantage of being able to run code in the kernel without the system knowing about
it. This is going to be a tough one to answer, isn't it?
But my question is,
he's already starting to sweat.
No.
He's seeing all the PR police in the campus coming into his office.
Well, no, I'm not going to ask that kind of question. I'm just curious from this new context and virtualization, sort of, that you're using for security, and it's not virtualization, it's just zones, as you mentioned. I keep thinking into the future.
Yeah.
Are rootkits going to be possible coming in through a channel that's running in low writes? In low writes, because the code still has to run.
Yeah. Okay. So, boy, let's see if I can rephrase part of your question.
Yeah.
Can even with all these boundaries in place, is it ultimately possible that something running at the lowest integrity or lowest privilege and lowest everything on the system mm-hmm. still managed to exploit something that's running at the highest level and cause a problem? Mm-hmm. Theoretically, it's certainly true, right? Mm-hmm. Are we doing everything we can about that? Yeah.
Cool.
I mean, obviously, it'd be stupid to say anything else, but
sure.
You know, fundamentally, we've found a class of issues where drivers are not always validating their inputs correctly. And you know, so we're taking pains to make sure that all the inbox drivers are doing the right thing. We're working with the driver vendors, the IHVs, as we call them, independent hardware vendors, to improve their code quality. We issued the DDK that went out, or that's not DDK anymore, I guess it's the Windows Driver Kit or whatever it's
foundation.
Called.
Foundation, yeah.
Well, there's the foundation you're supposed to use to program to and the whole kit that you get, but one of the tools that we include was the what we call Prefast, the static analysis tools that we use internally, so mm-hmm. that driver writers out in the real world can actually get the same benefits that we do mm-hmm. in terms of analyzing the code. And that continues to get updated and continues to benefit from annotation. The more annotations you do with your own code, the better the tool's going to become.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll see that particular evolution go on. If Daryl were in the office as opposed to next door, he would mm-hmm. say that eventually all drivers will be out of the kernel mode. There'll be some intermediate state between kernel and user where drivers run, and hopefully most drivers are running in user.
Mm-hmm. Well, you don't use Ring 1,
well,
do you?
No,
but you use 0 and 2, right?
0 and 3.
0 and 3.
On x86.
Okay.
x64, in the run of the mode that we run in, doesn't have rings.
Okay.
It just has user and supervisor. So,
interesting.
Well, and you know, rings have some advantages and some disadvantages. And I think what we'd really like to do is figure out what we want to do about how to write drivers correctly in the future to eliminate the need for rings as much as changing the whole model around, right? So if it, as you see right now, the user mode driver framework that's present, I guess we shipped it in server 03 and it's available down level, but it's definitely getting pumped up more in Vista.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, guess what? Driver's in user mode. End of story, right? It's in its own process, it's isolated from everything else, but you know, a lot of the work that it does is now in a place where it can't go and hose the rest of the world.
Excellent.
We're seeing that in video drivers, right? The new Vista, we used to call it Longhorn driver model, I don't know what we call it now, but what the video drivers are writing to, a lot more work is done in user mode, and the primitives that go from user mode to kernel mode are much simpler, so that there's less chance of accident. We know that during XPSV2 development time, we discovered problems in the DX sample code,
mm-hmm.
DirectX sample code, so that drivers that were trying to implement DirectX so security problems, we had to fix all those retroactively for XPSV2. So we, you know, obviously the simpler we can make the boundary, the better for everybody. This is one aspect of it. Now, so one of the security features that's going into Vista is the requirement for signed drivers. So X64 will require all drivers to be signed. And signed in a way that roots up to a key that we understand. It's not a configurable policy key anymore, because one thing that became apparent is you can have all this wonderful security about what you're going to trust and sign and everything else, but if the you know, the actual policy that controls what you're going to load is wide open on the disk, it doesn't really help you. You know, that becomes the attack point, not your wonderful signing mechanism.
Sure.
So the keys are hard-coded. We're going through the process of getting everybody up to speed. I noticed about a month ago the word went out to all the bulletin boards, and there are a couple of people who are complaining that we're trying to squash out, I guess, independent writers, which is obviously wrong. We love drivers. It makes our platform more exciting than
Absolutely.
Other platforms that don't have as many drivers as we do.
Precisely.
And also it doesn't you know, this model doesn't rule out the hobbyist, right? If you have a kernel debugger hooked up, we turn off the signing requirement so that the actual people who are writing drivers are not going to be hindered in their day-to-day activity. It's when they're released that these have to be signed.
Mm-hmm.
Would that prevent the newsworthy rootkit event that happened? No. It
mm-hmm.
would have caused exactly the same thing to happen, which was, hey, I know exactly where this code came from on my system. And I went after, and they went after the people who produced the code, and those people withdrew the code. So
yeah.
That's, you know, not everything can be solved with a technical solution. Some of these need to be social and.
But I mean, in that case,
legal.
And why? You know, will there be a time where you can't run arbitrary code in the kernel? And I know, I mean, will there come that time? And is that, I mean, is it possible, does it make sense that that ever be something that you could control, right? I mean.
Will there be a time when we can't run arbitrary code in the kernel? I hope so.
Uh-huh.
We're looking towards that. Last time we were talking, Daryl was talking about we want to get everything out of kernel mode. Yep.
That's a big step
because then it's only our code that runs in kernel mode. Everything else is somewhere else. Now that somewhere else is still going to have some level of privilege, so
sure.
It's not really a question of can we make sure that no arbitrary code runs the kernel. It's can you make sure that no arbitrary code runs code that you don't expect?
Okay.
That's where I'd like to get to. We have plenty of opportunity ahead of us to get to that stage, and we're looking at lots of ways. You guys did a Singularity talk.
Yes, we did.
Right. So Singularity is a great research effort, right? Because they're going through and saying, hey, can drivers be written in a way that protects against a variety of issues? Yes, as it turns out, you can write them in a way. Now, do we know exactly how to do that yet? No, we don't, because of the way the Bartok works, the Bartok cross-compiler works, you have to have full knowledge of everything, and you can't do libraries, and it's hard to do platforms correctly, and all sorts of other stuff. But, hey, we're learning a lot. So in the future, yes, things will be better, because we're going to change the way the extensibility and code generation patterns work for the higher privilege areas.
Excellent. And now, speaking of that, do you see one of the things the Singularity people are doing is they ask themselves, is it possible to write a secure, stable, reliable system beyond worrying about performance? Like, pretend like there's no infinite amount. And they've done, they made a really small kernel, but I'm going to ask you this. One of the reason they've been able to do this is because of managed code. And do you think there will be a day where we'll see some sort of managed code in Windows at the lowest levels? Managed meaning type safe. Do you know what I mean?
Well, actually, I'm waiting to hear exactly what you mean.
So, I mean, let's finish that. So type safe. Now, the one thing that I'm going to say, of course, that you're not going to like is garbage collected. Is that something that you think someday would see, like a light version of say, the CLR way down? In the depths of the OS.
The depths.
Okay. Do that again.
No, I don't think I'll do that again, actually. I didn't look good. Okay, so how do you answer this without getting the rest of the world pissed off at you? Yes, actually, I think we will see more structured code down in the kernel. Garbage collection is not inherently evil. It's you can't actually have real type safety without garbage collection. If you have alloc and free primitives in your environment, you cannot be fully type safe. That's kind of one of those little axioms.
Interesting. Yeah.
Right? Well, because if I have memory and it's an object 1 second and I free it and then the next thing I do is invoke it, you're not type safe, right? You've got rid of it.
I think we were talking before Charles got here about design decisions that were made 15, 20 years ago based on hardware that was far more constrained than today's hardware is, and what's tomorrow's hardware going to look like, and what are the mistakes you're making, or what are the trade-offs, I guess, because you can't put a garbage collector down there right now, right?
Well,
for performance reasons.
Actually, well, oh boy. yes, you can, right? Can we do it in Windows? That's a harder question to answer. Windows has a lot of other constraints, and it goes back to, hey, we're totally general purpose, and you got some people who've got real-time data acquisition things that have they're jammed into this thing, and you've got SQL Server or these high-end SAP servers running that absolutely just beat the crap out of the disk and use us as simply a device driver abstraction. Mm. So when you say, oh, at all scales, can you do anything you want in the kernel in Windows currently? No. Can you have a garbage collected system running in the kernel? Yes. We have a guy who's doing some experiments right now where he's got garbage collected schemes going. You can have reference count and garbage collection, which is everybody pays a cost, but it's predictable. You've got the multi-generational garbage collector that goes on now inside of the .NET frameworks, which has great performance characteristics in the sense that it can, you know, it can watch the way that objects, the total object lifetime, and choose the right moment to go and garbage collect. Mm-hmm. But when it does so, it needs to radically manipulate the environment to make sure that nothing else goes on that it doesn't expect. And that's a little bit harder to fit into an interrupt-driven environment.
True.
So the experiments that a guy over the driver's group is doing right now are around reference kind of garbage collector. Some of the early, and he's working with the Singularity guys in the background to say, oh, hey, you know, what have you guys done? And they've learned, you know, they've got, they have three different garbage collectors that they've been trying out, different scenarios. Mm-hmm. They've got, you can have different garbage collectors per running environment in the Singularity world. It's great. You know, they're trying all these things out. Okay. It's experimentation stage for us right now. So we don't, you know, I want to see a type-safe language used to, for any accessibility point, like a driver model, whether it's IL generated or whether it's, you know, a safer language that's used to generate x86 code that's then loaded. I don't know. You know, there's lots of different ways of doing that. But fundamentally, yeah, we do want to see things move on.
Absolutely.
That said, there are 240,000 drivers out in the world that we've seen. So,
yes.
We see a lot of data come back, and you know, there are 240,000 unique instances, and you know, obviously some of those are later versions of existing drivers, but the number of unique drivers is still really large. The number of family drivers is still very, very large. And the number of new drivers that we see every week is very, very large.
Wow.
But so now, if I wrote a driver that is now in user mode, do I have to make any changes to my code, or are you virtual? Are you, you have your proxy that you created?
In Vista, if you are writing to the new Windows driver framework, which is not the Windows driver model, but the new framework,
okay,
then you are, the interface is abstracted for both user and kernel mode.
Okay.
The dream is that we can relocate the drivers arbitrarily. The practicality will vary. And so, NIC drivers, for example, are very hard to move up to user mode because you have too many data copies, the NIC throughput goes down. Same, you know, and storage is like that. You know, video drivers, video capture drivers lend themselves very well to user mode. And you know, keyboard drivers, yeah, why not user mode? They're very low, you know, comparatively high latency, low throughput, you know, driven by a human.
Sure.
I'm pretty good. I type whatever 45 words a minute. That's nothing compared to what you're saying these things, you know, the hardware is capable of now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a transition. Right? We're going to see more people do things in the framework because it makes a lot of things easier. And so that's the initial hook. And then, you know, when they discover it's easier to write a driver, they can turn their hardware around faster. They don't have the support burden as much because the tougher synchronization things are abstracted away, then they're going to move on to write more drivers that way. And then as they do that, we can change the place where their driver lives in the system by keeping the interface the same, move their stuff into a safer place.
Excellent.
And to tie it all back to what you originally asked, okay, so can something running in the lowest writes, lowest integrity process bucket open a device and send down a bioctal? Yes. Is it going to take over the world? Probably not, right? Because now it's going to open this device, it's going to send an octal, and it's going to get routed through to some place that, even if it is a terribly written driver, it can't do any harm. It's in an equivalently low-privileged bucket. It only has access to a specific channel off of a USB bus or a specific set of ports and nothing else, as opposed to everything in the world.
Fantastic.
When I talk out on the street with normal people, not geeks, one of the things I hear is, why can't you guys just read through every line of source code and find all the bugs or security exploit places or...
Great. Oh, offer shifts even on camera. We do read through all the source code that we can. There's a lot of legacy code that it's hard to change. So if you, when you find problems, it's much more expensive to change. And
when you say expensive, are you talking about human time or money?
Human time.
Okay. Right.
Sorry. Yeah. It's the older something is, the less there is of. There are fewer people that know all the history behind why certain decisions were made and so forth. So it's harder to make simple. Or sorry, it's easy to make simple corrections like, oh, I got to count that stir copy. That's easy. That's trivial, and those things get done. There's this whole. There's a WMF thing as an example, right? That's, oh my God, what were they thinking? Well, okay, conspiracy theories aside. 14 years ago, 15 years ago, when the original Metafile stuff was going on, you had to render to printers in this way, and it wasn't really considered. This particular functionality was carried forward because it was just the way that the whole thing worked, and the fact that it didn't really work. The actual abort proc callouts didn't work correctly on alternate architectures, or didn't work correctly on x64 and all these other things. Well, yeah, because it never really worked, but these things just carried forward for not great reasons of compatibility. But on the other side, we learn every round, right? So we did the stand down for server 03. Had everyone go through and they had to review all the new code. They had to review all the existing code. They're looking for the set of things that we knew about, whatever that was. That was 02, I guess. So, 4 years ago, state of the art has moved forward. New threats, integer overflows. That's the classic. Integer overflows can happen in other ways too. So, update all the static tools to kind of these things. Update people, and updating tools is very economical. Updating people is expensive in terms of time. Again, right? You have to bring them all to a class. You have to teach them. They have to understand it all.
One of the stories I keep hearing is Michael Howard putting 10 lines of code or something around that on the board and saying, "Find me the buffer overrun." And very few people in the crowd can point that out. But, and it's in 10 lines of code. Right there in front of you.
Yeah.
It's hard stuff, in other words.
Not everything is. Not all code is perfect, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, and so if you don't. A lot of code reflects the assumptions and the components that surround it. So you could also look at that. You could take one of Mike's code snippets and say, "Oh my God, how could anyone be that stupid?" It's like, well, actually, if there was code right above it that said, "Okay, here's how I'm going to validate everything," so that the following conditions are known to be true, but you don't see that in the snippet, the code's still correct, but you just don't know, and then you have the worst problem, right? You make a bogus correction that causes a regression or something else.
Right.
So it's not free. And so the older the code is, once again, and the older the code is, the mm-hmm. less likely you have one of the original authors around who says, "Oh no, here's why we made that assumption. It's validated up here." And as people spend lots of time trying to figure out what the underlying assumptions are, they go, "Oh, this wasn't good." They can't look at all the rest of the code. What we do, we just actually one. More interesting things that we did in terms of engineering just recently was we have a tool, actually I think it's in the SDK now, called WinDiff, which lets you do side-by-side file comparisons and pretty straightforward. But we added a way for you to add a comment. So as you code review something, you can make a comment about why the change was done, what I noticed during my code review, cool. This guy made a change and now I'm annotating his change so that it's clear what the change was. That sounds so simple. Yeah, it is actually fairly simple. The guy just did it, and now it gets checked. The annotation gets checked into the source code system. Mm-hmm. It's preserved for all eternity. Woohoo!
Excellent.
It's an investment, but there are a lot of lines of code to go through and do all this with.
Absolutely, but it's an awesome snapshot of the evolution of Windows. And you guys have made dramatic progress, and that's awesome.
Thanks.
And I just wanted to say thanks. I know we took a lot of your time. Started a little late today. Thanks to Scobel. No, I'm just kidding. My bad. But thank you. And we want to keep talking to you core architect types because it's very interesting to see the thinking behind what's going on.
We're always full of opinions.
Good. Well, no, that's goodness. And excellent. Do you have any other questions, no. Mr. Scoble? Cool. We'll let him get back to work now.
Well, maybe closer to release, we'll come back and see the whole thing and talk about
it. Sure.
Are there too many dialogue boxes for my mom to dive through and stuff like that?
Well, you know, there's a gentleman down in the corner office down there who will be eager to hear your feedback on that. He has his own opinions.
Who's this?
Jim.
Oh, Jim Alchin.
Jim Alchin watches over the dialogue count very, very carefully. That's very entertaining.
Excellent.
Good, I'm glad.
No, he's not the detached executive. No, he's just the imagination.
I hear he does 2 to 4 installs of daily builds a day. That's what I've heard. That's a rumor I've heard.
Brian actually does all his own installs.
Brian does.
All this every day.
Valentine.
Jim, I think, has his people do his installs, but he does actually run current bits.
Sure.
He's actually very aggressive about that. He also sat down for the user experience review three days of going through all the user experience things. He had lots of feedback from the team.
Excellent. Well, he's great at that.
He's very involved.
I guess you're running it. What do you like best about Vista?
What do I like best about Vista?
Yeah. What's the one thing you couldn't do with that if I forced you to go back?
Well,
to
okay, so I take responsibility for owning WinLogon for 10 years. And so the fact that we completely gutted WinLogon and rewrote it, we being the team that owns it now, I like that. I like the session zero separation. Now I don't worry about all sorts of stupid anything. So again, another security feature, reliability feature, services that used to raise UI, not happening anymore, right? They're Excellent. In an isolated session. They can't interact. They're not subject to the same chatter attacks anymore. So
beautiful.
Anything else? You don't like the search engine? the new UI?
I don't search that way that often. So okay. Since I've had a history in computers, I organize my files myself, and therefore it's not as efficient for me. But I know that.
You're a hierarchical.
I'm a very hierarchical structure guy. I can also say that when the beta comes out, I'll take it home. My wife will enjoy being able to search the pictures and all of her mail and stuff like that. The new UI is snazzy. Glass is cool.
There's a bunch of new features in there, but. It's a hard question to ask someone that actually involves in making
systems. Like, I run a text mode window and I type build, right? You know, I'm not the best example of.
Well, are there any improvements to the command line?
Yeah, actually. Command.exe is transaction aware now, I found out. That was a little surprise.
Wow. Yeah. See, you can start
asking
a transaction.
Questions,
I learned a little bit more.
You can start a transaction from the command line?
Yeah.
I heard there's 2,700 features, and I've only heard about 50 of them, so yeah. I have a lot of work to do.
Features have varying granularity, right? So,
Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
Thanks.
Great. Cool. Thanks.